Well, is there such a thing as Australian jazz, or is there just jazz made in Australia? Australian jazz would have once been considered an oxymoron, but in jazz, the Australian accent, it's suggested that Australia has become a creative centre of jazz, rivaling the Scandinavian and Western European countries that have steadily diluted New York's preeminence over the last three decades. Through interviews, anecdotes, analysis and a companion CD, Jazz, the Australian Accent provides a fascinating insight into the innovative, cutting-edge scene that is Australian jazz. Well, my guest in the studio is a music critic, author, playwright and librettist. He's written about jazz in over a dozen publications and has been resident critic at the Sydney Morning Herald since 1993. He's previously published Don't Shoot the Best Boy, The Film Crew at Work, about feature filmmaking in Australia, and The Phantom of the Soap Opera, a play for teenagers. He's also been a working jazz musician. The author of Jazz, the Australian Accent, John Shand, welcome to Now's the Time.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Congratulations, firstly, on a very, very compelling read.
Thank you.
Can we start by getting to have an insight into your background? It might help our listeners get a better understanding about how you formed your ideas about music. What circumstances were you first attracted to jazz, and who were your major influences?
When I was a child, my mother had the Stan Getz Bossa Nova albums. When I was, say, 7 or 8, I'd have first been exposed to those. And then also through her, I heard people like Benny Goodman and the other big bands of the 1940s. Then I had my sister's first husband was a keen jazz fan. He introduced me to people like Monk and Miles. And then my own listening to the prog rock bands of the 70s, I'd follow musicians who were guesting on a certain album. They'd spiral off in other directions, and some of those would end up being, for instance, some of the British jazz scene players, Keith Tippett's, Elton Dean, Mark Charig, Nick Evans, those sorts of people. Following them, I got on to the South African jazz scene that had migrated to London in the mid-60s. And then, because I'd already discovered Monk and Miles, of course, I was also aware of what was happening in America and started to follow that more strongly, particularly, I suppose, the developments of the 1960s onwards, the free scene and so on. And so I got, you know, by the middle of the 70s, I was very involved in bands like the Art Ensemble of Chicago and Archie Shepp and obviously Coltrane and the rest of it. So there was a gamut there from the early days via my mother, I suppose, and things like Getz, and then an early awareness that it was more than just an American music, that very interesting things were being done in London and South Africa well before I became aware of them.
And, of course, that's really the underlying theme to the book Jazz, the Australian Accent. And I must admit, I read this on the way down to Wangaratta on the train, and I kept on asking myself, have you set out to dispel a myth or document a reality? Can you tell us what drove you to write this book? Has it been an underlying desire of yours?
No, I was asked to write a book on Australian jazz, and in the minds of the publishers, University of New South Wales Press, it was to be a follow-up to John Clare's Bodgy Dada and the Cult of Cool, which was also published by them, but back in 1995. And it struck me that merely updating John's book was going to be a very difficult and perhaps unrewarding task, and that it was going to be very hard not to overlap for a start. And he'd already so comprehensively covered what had happened from around 1945 to 1995 that an overlap seemed redundant. To very stringently try and just cover the last dozen years seemed to, in a way, to have not enough to write about potentially. And so I thought, what were the other options on ways of going about writing a book on contemporary Australian jazz? And I decided that that question of whether there was such a thing as Australian jazz or just jazz and made in Australia was the interesting one to tackle. It's long been the kind of over the bottle of wine at the dinner table kind of conversation for those who are interested. And So I settled on a format of players whom, in my estimation, were ones who had made a contribution that on the world stage was unique, that could only have happened in Australia, arguably. And whilst the people that I cover in the book are not the only ones that this applies to, in my estimation, they're particularly good examples.
That brings to me the question, what criteria did you apply for the artists that you have profiled here? Because there's, what, about 17 artists?
17 of them, yeah.
And I was wondering that because there are some obvious names that, that even you'd be able to point to that you would have had to leave out.
Yes. I suppose the first point was that I had a choice on doing a lot of people in less detail or fewer people in more detail. And given that for such a long time I've been writing for the newspaper in very confined spaces, the luxury that was afforded to me by this opportunity was one of writing more expansively, finally. As much as I've written about it in all sorts of magazines and newspapers over the years, there's always a word limit. Mm. I mean, there was a word limit for the book too, but at least it was 60,000 words rather than 300 words or 80 words or 1,000 words or whatever it might be in a periodical. And so given that opportunity to write more expansively, I chose the option of writing about fewer people in greater depth. And I stand by that decision, even though there's already been some dissent about people who quite obviously are, in some sense, left out. I make it clear in the preface that the people who are in are not the only examples of people who have made unique jazz here in Australia. But I am absolutely sure in my own mind that the people that I've got in are very good examples of those that have done that.
There's little doubt about that.
Yes. I mean, you know, to talk about the people who are in rapidly, Bernie McGann, John Poche, Mike Nock, Alan Brown, Phil Treloar, Mark Simmons, the three members of the Necks, Scott Tinkler, the three members of the Julian Wilson Trio, the three members of Band of Five Names, and James Muller. And all of them, not necessarily individually, because as I've just enumerated, in three cases it's a band, but all of them, either as a band or as individuals, have done something fairly astoundingly original, I feel.
Especially in the case of the Necks. Something yes. That's been exported.
Yes. And look, no one who plays the alto saxophone on the planet sounds like Bernie McGann. No one who plays the guitar, that most universal of instruments, sounds like James Muller. Scott Tinkler and Phil Slater, the trumpeter in Band of Five Names, to me, two of the major trumpet players on the world stage at the moment. And so it goes on. I mean, Mark Simmons, I suppose when I was drawing up my list of people who would be in, which a list that was once about five times as long as those who ended up in the book, probably the first name on that list was Mark Simmons. Probably the second name on that list was Phil Treloar. And those two, I think, have been absolutely pivotal to the local scene, even though for different reasons neither of them are currently active on the local scene.
I've chosen Bernie McGann and John Poche, a duo. In fact, it's not a duo,
no,
is it?
No, it's a quartet.
It's a quartet with Warwick Alder on the trumpet, Lloyd Swant on the bass, and John Poche on the drums. And this is a piece which was written by McGann entitled D-Day. He performed this with the Dale Barlow group at Wangaratta this year, and it felt like an old classic Blue Note bebop tune to me. You must have chosen some of these pieces for a specific purpose. Tell us about this one.
Bernie's solo in this, to me, encapsulates all that I most love about Bernie. As I recall, in the very opening bars of his solo, there's these astoundingly gruff notes on an alto saxophone. It's a sound that you don't expect to come out of an alto. It's lower, it's thicker, it's growly and coarse-grained, and it's nothing like the typical bebop alto sound for a start. Then there is the way he constructs the solo, the melody lines, the phrasing. To me, it reeks of everything that is so different about Bernie. I mean, one of the other people in the book, Julian Wilson, the Melbourne tenor player, said to me, and it's an anecdote that's recounted in the book, that he once jumped in his car, turned on the radio, and it was on a jazz station, and he heard one note of a song and he said to himself, that's Bernie McGann. The second note confirmed that he was right. And in the whole gamut of the music, the whole history of the music, there are really, I don't think, that many players that you could be absolutely sure after hearing one note who it was. And Bernie is among them, and that is a remarkable achievement.
You could count them on one hand, probably.
Probably.
And I'd like to play devil's advocate for a moment, John, if I may. There might be some that would suggest that if there seems to be a need for the very act of setting out a case for an Australian sound, that it might suggest indeed that the Australian sound is not as distinctive as suggested here. What do you say in response to that?
I actually agree with that. The conclusion that the book draws, I think, is that unlike South Africa or Norway, to draw two particularly clear examples, jazz here hasn't evolved into something that is clearly discernible as being Australian jazz. That is Bernie, who we just listened to on the one hand, and the Necks on another, for instance, sound nothing like each other, despite the fact in this case they even share the bass of Lloyd Swanton. There is no relationship in approach and sound in anything, whereas most South African jazz sounds like South African jazz and a lot of Norwegian jazz sounds like Norwegian jazz. So that conclusion, I think, is established reasonably early in the book. The book then moves on from that is in terms of if there's not something that is discernible as being Australian jazz, there is still jazz made in Australia that is unique. And so that's the point of view that I think the book is trying to sustain.
Do you feel as though you've answered the question, is there such a thing as Australian jazz?
I think in the terms that I just enunciated, that it's not, there's no through line that you can trace. Not just don't the Necks and Bernie sound anything like, but the Julian Wilson Trio doesn't sound anything like the Phil Slater Quartet. They're very different sorts of practitioners, but in each case, they've absorbed what's happened in America over a century. They've listened to what's happened in Europe and elsewhere. And I think most tellingly of all, Frank, what they do is they've listened to their forebears here. And I think this is one point that I am strenuously making in the book, that when John Pochet and Bernie McGann were first making this music in Sydney in the late 1950s, they didn't have many people that they could go and listen to who were making bebop or post-bebop jazz and learn from. When Roger Frampton and Phil Treloar were doing it a decade later, they had Bernie and Pochet and Bob Birtles and the rest to go and hear. When then people like Steve Elphick and Mark Simmons came along, they could go and hear Roger Frampton and Phil Treloar and the Bernie Pochet generation. We move further down the line another 5 years and the members of the Necks, Tony Buck, Chris Abrams and Lloyd Swanton have come along. They can now hear Mark Simmons and Steve Elphick and all the precursors. And then we get to the people who are now in their mid-30s, Matt McMahon, Phil Slater, Simon Barker, James Muller, and they had the whole Lloyd Swanton, Sandy Evans, James Greening generation to listen to, as well as that ever-growing batch of precursors. So the kids who are now 20 to 25, they have hundreds of world-class musicians to listen to here. In other words, jazz stopped being something that was done over there. Jazz became something that was done here. And so a young guitarist here might be just as excited about the latest James Muller album as the latest John Scofield album, with good reason. In my estimation, Muller's the more interesting guitar player. And so that process, generation by generation, the number of influences increases, and people, the most exciting way to absorb the music is not from records, even if it is Kind of Blue or A Love Supreme. The most exciting way to absorb the music is live, and the more wonderful players you have to go and hear live, the richer the scene is.
So it's sort of like it's been a building block, really.
Yes.
And the people like you mentioned, Pochet and Bernie McGann, really didn't have that American influence, that direct American influence, it may have been there, but they were inventing something unique.
Yeah, they'd hear the occasional record and then kind of make up their way of doing that. And we're not just talking about an Australian scene here to a large degree, we're also talking about a New Zealand scene, because the two are very incestuously interbred. And between Australia and New Zealand, there's been a tradition, not just in the arts, but in matters mechanical or other things, of knowing a bit and making up the rest. And I think Antipodean jazz is another example of that, ultimately.
So a greater part of that original DNA still exists in the music we hear today from the Band of Five Names, for example.
For instance, despite the fact that those guys, or two of the three, have been and studied at institutions and learned formally about the music to some degree, despite that, what Phil Slater and Matt McMahon and Simon Barker have come up with is amazingly original to me. And making it even more interesting is the fact that they're working in at least two different formats. Band of Five Names, which is the three of them without a bass player, largely free improvising, and the Phil Slater Quartet, the three of them plus Lloyd Swanton on bass, playing very open-ended Phil Slater compositions. Then there's the Matt McMahon Trio without Phil, with Simon and with John O'Brown on bass, playing Matt's compositions much nearer a jazz tradition, I guess. But there, through those different projects, they've grown collectively as players. They, as kids, they were listening to people like Wynton Marsalis. Now, it's very, very hard to hear any hint of Wynton Marsalis in the music of Phil Slater as it's played today. And one of the interesting things, I think, about players who end up expressing themselves with a degree of rigorous truth is that they might, in their own mind, still hear their influences being quite paramount in the music they're making, but to the outsider, it's completely dissipated. And so a lot of musicians, like Tony Buck in the book, talks about being worried that his influences are still too easily discernible, but I defy anyone to hear them now. I think it's in the mind of the artist, the strength of those influences, but you're processing it through this kind of prism of self, and out the other end of that comes your own way of doing it, even if you think in your mind you're still copying your favourite drummer or your favourite trumpeter or your favourite guitarist while you're doing it.
Well, indeed. A name that pops up in the book a number of times but is not heavily profiled is Bob Gebert.
Yep.
And talking to him, he has been quite inspired by the American jazz scene. But listening to him, yes, there might be some influence of Monk in his sound, but essentially, it is still a very, very unique sound.
Yes.
A sound that probably is inspired by the hard bop scene, but was very, very involved with the free jazz scene as well.
Yes. I think as soon as you have more than one arch influence, then what comes out the other end is not going to sound like the influences, because you're already combining. And most people, like if you're a drummer, you might love both Elvin Jones and Paul Motion, say. Now, Paul Motion and Elvin Jones play nothing like each other. So therefore, if you're inspired by both of them, what comes out the other end of that process isn't presumably going to sound like either of them.
One of the aspects of the book that makes it so credible for me is the number of quotations from the artists themselves, and indeed the number of communications that you would have had to do via email, live interviews or whatever is quite phenomenal. Most of them give the reader a unique insight into the true essence of their art, which is personal expression. If I can just quote for our listeners from the trumpet of Phil Slater, he says, "It's a form of expression, but the form of expression comes after it being fun. It's just as much fun for me to play now as it was when I started. Obviously, you want more challenges, so you can do different things with music, or your ears develop over the years to accept more tension or more release. And of course, you're picking up influences all along. But it's ultimately moving and freeing. Moments of disappearing and of flying, you just lose all sense of time. That could be some sort of endorphin thing. God only knows what that is. But that's what it's about for me, getting that feeling that's beyond excitement."
Yes.
It's quite an incredible...
Yes.
Because when you witness Phil Slater on the stage, he looks anything but like he's having fun. But it's a much deeper personal, internal feeling that he's getting. And I think, from the point of view, I think it's important for newcomers for jazz, in relation to Slater's comments there, and indeed all these comments in the book, that the idea of newcomers to jazz, to understand that motivation for each performance being a personal expression, and that's in contrast to different other forms of music, replicating recorded versions or scored music, for example.
Mm.
Was that something that surprised you, that theme that came out, that personal expression?
No, it didn't. Though I hasten to add that in relation to Phil, whom I'd always had pegged as having quite an intellectual approach to the process of making the music, not the end product, which is intensely emotional, but the process, I was quite surprised to find that in process terms, he is in fact eager to get away from the intellectual and make a beeline for that emotional content in methodology terms. What I've tried to do in the interviews was try and extract the methodology of the players and find what was in common or what was different from player to player and the way they go about making the music. And, for instance, Scott Tinkler, the other trumpeter in the book, whom I had pegged in my mind as being probably the most visceral player on any instrument in the country, just about, he has a very intellectual approach to arriving at that visceral end product. Phil seemingly has an intellectual approach to arriving at a very emotional end product, but it's not really like that at all. The intellectual aspect is very much buried. Phil's absorbed a whole lot of the processes of classical composition, and it underpins or gives gravitas, if you like, to his music. But he's in no way being weighed down by that. It's all about trying to arrive at the point where the freedom of expression amongst the members of the band is given the ultimate reign.
The common thread, of course, in this book, John, is that I found amongst the musicians you've closely examined was that there's no longer this feeling to put American jazz heroes on a pedestal.
Mm.
Conversely, though, are you necessarily implying that Australian artists that perhaps still do that to a certain degree are not as distinctively Australian in their sound?
Not necessarily, but I think that one of the things that the book is documenting is that ceasing to do that is a liberating experience for the musician. That as long as you set up little gods on pedestals and bow down before them, you're going to be demeaning yourself as an artist, because you're always going to be thinking, I'm not as good as John Coltrane, I'm not as good as Miles Davis, I'm not as good as Duke Ellington, I'm not as good as Lester Bowie or whoever it might be. As soon as you get out of that mindset and realise that going to hear the Phil Slater Quartet live is as exciting as listening to Miles Davis on record, then I think a major step forward has been made. And because you hear them doing it, and they're real people that you can go and talk to after the gig, or buy the CD of, or go and buy a lesson from, or go and hear again the next week, gigs allowing in our gig-deprived town, then you're relating to it in a different way. You're not relating to it as something that's mysterious and comes from overseas and is made by African Americans from a previous generation. You're relating to it as music that is made by real people in the here and now, and if they can do it, then you can bloody do it too.
Do you think that any of the resistance to American jazz by Australians was interrelated amongst the politics of the last 8 years and therefore might change now that the Democrats are in?
No, I don't think so. I think it's entirely extraneous. And I don't think that there's any sense of feeling, how do I put this, some sort of antipathy towards Americans. And I don't think that's in any sense the point of the book. I think that you accept the American scene for what it is. That is the home of jazz, the place where it all began. But in the first chapter, I mount the case that from the moment jazz moved northward from New Orleans towards Kansas City and ultimately Chicago and New York, it was really moving out into the world. From the moment it left New Orleans, it was on a worldwide spread. And within, by 1920, people would go and hear jazz in Europe. Let's not forget that. So that spread happened remarkably quickly. It's just that it took until the best part of 1970 before the people who were making it elsewhere in the world were making it as originally as had been the case in America through the preceding 50 years. The exception is Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli. They came up with their own thing in the very early days of the music that didn't sound like anything that had been happening in America, and they're a remarkable exception to the rule. But really, you know, you had what we now call classic or trad jazz and swing and bebop and the free scene and jazz rock. All those developments occurred in the US. But then in the wake of those, once the American scene kind of ran into a brick wall of not being able to reinvent itself as something as distinctive as all those phases had been up to that point, the rest of the world leapt into the breach and said, oh, look, we can make South African jazz, we can make Norwegian jazz, we can make Dutch jazz, and they all sound quite different to what you've been doing over there, and they're another way forward. And of course, part of that was the intersection with the folk music of those countries. Just as jazz had been based on what we might call the African-American folk music of blues and gospel, so once you started taking a Norwegian folk song and putting a soprano saxophone on it, it sounded suddenly like something that had very little to do with the cotton fields of Mississippi or Louisiana.
And, of course, some of the regional rhythms, for example, in South Africa.
Yes, yeah, they take the tribal rhythms and some of those melodies but play them with jazz instrumentation. And they very, I mean, by 1965, South African jazz was clear and distinct on the world stage. That's a remarkable thing. There are a few places that I think can make that claim.
In an interview in the early 1990s, Sandy Evans told me that jazz was a very masculine art form. Given that only two pages out of the 200 here focuses on females in jazz, it seems like little has changed in all that time. What do you think is holding women back in jazz, and is it just an issue in Australia?
No, it's a worldwide issue, and it's one that puzzles me deeply. It's one that I've discussed with Sandy and others, and the only explanatory theory I can come up with is that one that I alluded to before, this idea that each generation has more role models than the preceding one. That is even perhaps more the case in relation to women. And so when Sandy came along, she could go and hear Judy Bailey, and maybe Kerry Bedell was singing, or there might, you know, there were the odd others, quite often singers specifically rather than instrumentalists. Very, very few instrumentalists for her to go and hear. And now there are more, but it's still infinitesimal. It's probably still a proportion not dissimilar to the proportion of the book that they occupy. But perhaps it is now doubling generation by generation, and perhaps something approaching the sort of parity that you might have expected will occur in a generation's time if the music is still going strong in some guise. But it is odd, and Sandy has explained to me, as I presume she did to you, that the experience that learning musicians obviously often have, kids in their teens, of joining a big band, if that big band is 16 males and one girl and you're 16 or 17, it perhaps is not the most comfortable place to be always. Might be quite exciting in some ways, but it might not be the most comfortable environment to put yourself in. It might be much easier to go and learn the violin and join the amateur, the string section of the local amateur orchestra. There is this clear dichotomy that whereas probably more than 50% of most contemporary orchestras are female, 5% of all jazz musicians or less are female. And I think that most male jazz musicians, because it's the music, the sort of music that they relate to, are not going to be boorish, sexist, particularly boofhead kind of guys, but nonetheless, in a learning environment in a big band, perhaps it might be confronting, and there the girls need to be exposed to a wide array of role models doing it to think, ah, yes, I can do that, just as Phil Slater needed to hear Mark Simmons or whatever in order to think, ah, oh, I could do something quite original and still be an Australian jazz musician.
John Shand, thanks very much for joining me in the studio tonight.
Thank you.